Hello, and welcome to I'm the Eggpod with me, Chris Shaw. The Eggpods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by journalist and author of books such as George Harrison, Behind the Locked Door, and most recently, Small Hours, The Long Night of John Martin. It's Graham Thompson.
Hey, Chris, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good.
Good.
Your latest book's been in all the Music Book of the Year awards, I see. You must be pretty happy with that.
I'm delighted with that. Yeah, no, kind of all the end of year. Well, not all of them, let's be fair. Most of them, some of them.
The key ones.
Yeah, yes. The important ones.
Yeah.
I had a hunch, you know, John Martin, he's such an interesting guy, or an interesting collection of personalities bunched into one person. And I think musically so rich, you know, there's so much going on in his music. People like him, you know, and so I was really gratified to see that it struck a chord with people, that book, you know, and it's quite a raw book. You know, I wanted to write something that was very honest and true about his nature, that didn't kind of skirt the darker sides of his personality. So I'm really, really, really pleased to see that it's been embraced by people and it's doing well and hopefully continue to do well. Paperback should be out some point this year. So, it's been fun.
Superb. Obviously, it's a Beatles podcast. I'm going to go down this road. Why did you pick George, of all the Beatles, to do a book about?
Yeah, I'm asked that quite often. And, quite often what I say is, and it seems maybe a bit weird because we're talking about a Beatle, but I felt he was a bit underrated, you know? I think there was still something to say about George in a way that maybe there isn't certainly about John and Paul. I felt there was still something interesting to say about him. And I hadn't read a book about him that kind of followed him right the way through his life and treated the Beatles, of course, as an important part of that, but in context. So everything that he did didn't necessarily relate back to the Beatles all the time. You know, he was his own man. He had his own life. You know, he had this, you know, 10-year period when he was in the biggest band in the world. But, you know, more than half of my book is related to the end of the Beatles and what happens after that. And I think that was really important to kind of try and put that in context. And he was such, again, you know, such an interesting kind of collection of personality traits and contradictions.
Yes, yeah.
You know, massive contradictions and ones that he acknowledged and kind of, I think, played with in a way and had fun with at certain times in his life. So it kind of seems weird to say it because we're talking about the Beatles and they've been, you know, trawled over so much that I just felt there's a path I can follow through this life that might reveal something that hasn't kind of come out about him before, or at least there's things I want to say about him. I suppose you kind of recognize people that you feel a connection to. And I suppose in the Beatles, it was always George for me. You know, I thought there was things there that really interested me. And of course, I found out a lot more. You know, that's a great thing about writing books is you kind of find out. You only find out the book you're going to write once you've finished it, really. You know, you have lots of grand plans, but you get to the end and go, okay, so that's the book I was going to write. Interesting.
So tell me, when did you first discover the Beatles?
I have a copy of Hard Day's Night that belongs to my parents. That predates long before I was born. I remember that being around the house. And I remember the early songs were part of my childhood. So, you know, I would hear She Loves You or I Want to Hold Your Hand in the car. And then I suppose, you know, the next song that resonated with me that had a Beatles connection was Mull of Kintyre. That was one of the first, if not the first singles that I bought. And I would have been, or got, I was maybe 4 or 5. I loved that song. I still love that song.
Yeah.
I went to see him recently. I went to see Paul McCartney a couple of years ago and he didn't play it. And I thought, that's a shame. And what a tune. And being Scottish, I think there was that sort of connection. You know, we lived up in the Highlands at that time in my life. And I thought, I kind of recognized that. So I did, but I don't think I knew who he was. I don't think I kind of understood he was the Beatle at that point. But and then I suppose I remember the Sgt. Pepper 20th anniversary, which I would have been 13. And I remember trying to get into Sgt. Pepper at that point and not really managing it. And still not managing it. So to a certain degree, never been a record I've really kind of loved in a way that I love other Beatles records. But I suppose that was the beginning of kind of understanding what this band was and who they were and the meaning of the importance of them as a group culturally, as much as anything. And then I kind of went back from there. By the time I was in my mid-teens and certainly a student, you know, I think the White Album was the one I kind of immersed myself in. And I think around, you know, the early 90s when there's kind of, I feel there was a kind of revival in the Beatles and hearing Revolver and going, this, my goodness, yeah, I can hear so much of what, you know, what is going on now and what's going on, I think, in the 80s, indie music, guitar music.
Yeah.
And then you start reading about it. You know, I started reading Revolution in the Head. I've still got my kind of first edition hardback of that. Yeah, so it's just kind of step-by-step path. Still finding out stuff now, really.
Yeah. Aren't we all?
Aren't we all?
So the album we're going to be talking about today is Wonderwall Music from 1968. Why are we talking about this?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's such a facet. It's one of the great things I took away from writing the book about George was discovering this record, which I didn't know. Like a lot of people, you know, my main connection with it was Oasis, you know, the song. And when that song came out, people go, oh, it's a George Harrison song. And I was like, is it? Because I've never heard a George Harrison song called Wonderwall, so I didn't really relate it to that. And then discovering how important it is in terms of his journey and his career, his kind of loosening of the bonds of the Beatles. And actually, you know, one of my theories in the book is that George became hugely kind of influential in pushing the narrative of the band from sort of late 67 onward. You know, and I'm surprised more people haven't made that connection that, you know, he goes to Bombay to record tracks for this record in early 1968. And a month later, they're in Rishikesh. And you know, he's kind of at that point driving the narrative of the band in a way that would have been inconceivable even, you know, 2 years before. And it's, you know, it's the first solo Beatles record. It's the first record ever released on Apple. It predates the White Album. It's a mad, I mean, musically, completely mad all over the place. Cornucopia, kaleidoscope of different styles. You know, he's barely on it. You know, it's his name's on the cover, but it's kind of directed by George Harrison, you know, and it's almost like a kind of a primer or a sampler of his musical passions, past and present and future. So I find it fascinating. I think the story behind it, the music on it, the least interesting thing about it is probably the film that it accompanied, which, you know, long forgotten and probably for good reason. But so for all those reasons, I think it's a really worthy addition to his catalogue, and one that quite often gets overlooked, that it's, you know, All Things Must Pass was the first George Harrison record. Well, no, it wasn't.
Yeah.
This was.
So the album was recorded in England and India between November 67 and February 68. It was released on the 1st of November 1968. And as you say, it was mostly instrumental, and it was on a soundtrack album for Joe Massett's film Wonderwall, which starred Jack McGarran as Oscar Collins, a dirty old scientist who drills holes through his wall to leer over Penny Lane, who was played by Jane Birkin, and her boyfriend Ian Quirre. And Joe actually approached George to provide the music, and it became the album released on the Apple label, primarily because that was the only way he could get it out. But I think the story, if you talk about the Indian music, the story really begins back in August 1966, when George went to India and started getting together with Ravi Shankar.
Yeah, or even before that. You know, I think, you know, the methodology that we hear on Wonderwall is, you know, if you think of Love You Too on Revolver, and that idea of bringing in outside musicians to kind of play on those songs, it's all tied in with his discovery of firstly the Indian music and the sitar and Ravi, and then, you know, it bleeds into his love of India itself and Indian spiritualism, Indian philosophy, and it becomes an obsession. And so what you hear, you know, on Revolver and on Sgt. Pepper and on the Magical Mystery Tour is kind of George tuning out, you know? I mean, we have this kind of opus, Within You, Without You, on Sgt. Pepper, but he's very kind of disinterested in anything else that's happening on that record.
Especially Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah, I mean, he's, you know, he's drawing with crayons, I think. He's, you know, as they're shooting the video, you know, he's kind of, and he's gone. You know, I think he literally has, his mentally, he is, you know, I write in the book, you know, the process of him leaving the band, I think, started probably in August 1966. And when they stopped playing live, you know, he's mapping a new identity for himself as a musician. And you kind of hear it waxing and waning through the last 3 or 4 years of the Beatles. But the music on Wonderwall Music is much more passionately conceived, I think, than anything on Magical Mystery Tour or Sgt. Pepper, in terms of George's input into the music. And he said, you know, he said he took this opportunity. He was asked by Joe Massett, who I think had worked with Jenny Boyd, who was the sister of Patty Boyd, who was George's wife, you know, he was asked to do this. And he said, well, this, you know, I specifically took on the job as a kind of, as an opportunity to have a shop window for Indian music. This is my chance to kind of present the music, the instruments, you know, as a whole. There's not just a sitar on this record, there's a whole range of beautiful traditional music, classical Indian instruments like the shanai and the santur and all these beautiful kind of sounds, and to get these musicians to play. So it was very consciously conceived as a way of him to do that and to get try and push this music into a kind of wider context. So it as you say, it's something that you can trace back to 65, 66 when that passion began. It continues obviously after this, but you could say this is in some way the high watermark of him engaging with that music. You know, we don't hear as much Indian music on any George Harrison record before or since. So it's a really unique opportunity to kind of listen to what was turning him on at that time.
And we're going to be going through some of the highlights of the album. So we start the album with Microbes, and we're immediately transformed to India. And this is Sharad Jadhav and Hanuman Jadhav on the shanhais. It's a musical instrument made out of wood with a double reed at one end and a metal or wooden flared bell at the other end. Thank you, Wikipedia.
Yep, we all knew that, though.
But we're immediately transformed. People buying this would have seen the cover and they would have opened the gatefold and seen the picture of George Harrison, thinking, well, it's a soundtrack album, what's it going to be? And immediately this points the way, although in many respects it doesn't.
No, well, that's the beauty. Nothing points the way to anything on this record, because as soon as you think, oh, it's an album of you know, sparse Indian classical instrumentals, you get a cowboy song, or you get a kind of fuzz-toned blues kind of rock song. So it points the way in as much as nothing is typical of the music on this record. But it's very, I mean, as you say, it's a very quite challenging opening to a record. And it's this kind of high keening, almost atonal organism of sound, Microbes. You know, it actually fits the title very well, because it does feel like something's kind of crawling under a microscope, which is kind of where it fits in the film. It's very unusual. A lot, and I think, you know, with 50 odd years hindsight, whatever, 60 years, God.
I know.
You know, a lot of people would never, we just would not have heard these sounds.
No.
You know, we of course become a bit more accustomed to that now, but it would have sounded very alien, I think, and quite exotic. And he doesn't play with exoticism, you know, it's very authentically done. You know, I think that's the point of having these players on there, is that it is done with kind of great care and consideration for the tradition that it comes from. I mean, one thing that's intriguing about this album is how he wrote some of these songs, you know, because I don't know how he would have written Microbes. It's not on record how that came to be.
Well, there's with the Sergeant Pepper box set, you can hear him when they're doing Within You, Without You, and he's instructing the players, and he's really on the ball. He's counting all the, I can't do it, but doing all the timing and singing the melody to them. So I think a lot of it is more hands-on than we may think, because I always assumed he just said, right, to do that kind of thing. But I think I think it was pretty full-on, and, you know, melodies.
There's no question about that. And I spoke to John Barham, who was very instrumental in the arrangement of this record and a few other ones, and he was kind of astonished how much George knew and how much he understood and how well he could communicate his ideas to other musicians. So no, he would have been, you know, whether he just had an idea for a sound and kind of then managed to communicate that to the musicians, whether he had something on harmonium or sitar that was the beginning of it and that was picked up, I don't know. But no, there's no question that he was really, by this point he understood the music, even if he couldn't play it as well as, you know, obviously these musicians. He'd study it for decades. He understood what he wanted to communicate, and I think he knew how to do that. Because, you know, these record, you know, the Bombay sessions, I think, were done in 3 or 4 days. It was very quick.
Yeah.
So he must have been pretty good at that, I think. I think as a Beatle as well, you have a kind of, you know, George, I don't think, played the Beatle card all that often, but you have a sort of ingrained confidence in your own ideas that would have helped at that point to kind of say, well, this is what I want.
So we move on to track two, Red Lady 2. He's kind of doing the same thing here that he did in India with the Remo 4, using them as musicians in exactly the same way he'd used the guys in India. And the Beatles had known Remo 4 since 1960. Paul was particularly keen, and he'd watched them on his night off. And they soon became an in-demand backing band for Georgie Fame, Billy Fury, and Billy J. Kramer. They had quite a high turnover of members by the time George asked them to provide the music. And at this point, the band comprised Tony Ashton, Roy Dyke, Phil Rogers, and Colin Manley. So I'm guessing that would have been deliberate.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, what I was told about those sessions was that he was... No, because George was very meticulous. So he'd already seen, he had very, very distinct time frames for each piece of music. So he had it kind of mapped out with a stopwatch, and he was saying, right, we have 1 minute, 32 seconds here to put some music in. And indeed, right at the end, Joe Massett went, this is incredible. I don't need to cut anything. Everything fits exactly scene by scene, which I think is very unusual for film writing. But I spoke to Roy Dyke, who played drums, who's still with us, or was still with us when I wrote the book. And, he said that was very free. George would come up with an idea for a kind of motif or a theme for a couple of minutes, or there'd be a piano lick, or there'd be a guitar riff or something, and they would just fall into it. So as much as things were kind of written or sketched out, they weren't, he wasn't sort of telling people exactly what to play. It was quite loose. And that's a love, so track one and two, you get the kind of dichotomy of the record in a way. You get, firstly, you get that beautiful Eastern Indian music, and then you get a kind of Western tune, a very pretty tune. And so we kind of get a sense of where this might be going. And it is interesting because you could, as an album, you could have done this. I mean, you could have had one side with Indian music and one side with Western music, which may have in some ways made more kind of thematic sense, but he doesn't do that.
No.
It's completely mixed. So it's, the mood on it's quite jarring in a way, because it can be very intense and very beautiful, and then it can be very quite jocular. It can be quite heavy at times. It does kind of move a lot as a record, it has a lot of dynamic in it.
Yeah.
Using the Remo 4 was really interesting. It's kind of going back to that kind of very early days of the Beatles in Hamburg and Merseybeat and all that. And again, that seemed to appeal to George. He was a very interesting musician in that sense, in that he could be very forward-thinking, and yet he was also kind of always rooted in the tradition in a way, in traditional rock and roll, traditional country music. And again, this record, you get both of those things very, very clearly. You get the just kind of bash it out and connecting to his Liverpool roots, and then you get something much more exotic and kind of progressive.
Next, we have track three, Tabla and Pacavage. A tabla, obviously, is a pair of twin-hand drums, and a pacavage is a barrel-shaped two-headed drum.
And it's Mahapurush Misra, who's playing on this record, plays on this song, plays both those instruments. I think it's as simple as that. I think they were recording fairly freely in Bombay. And one of the things about these tracks is that they kind of fade in and fade out almost, So you can hear that they're probably parts of perhaps a much longer piece, much longer extemporizations, and they're shaved, to fit the scene in the film or the relevant part of the film that it fits. So that, this is a fragment, so it's 64 seconds of those two instruments sort of interacting.
drilling home the Mellotron one.
Yeah, I suppose that's the other side of George, you know, is that kind of jocular, slightly jokey, and I suppose fits in with the film in a sense, which is that 60s, late 60s, you know, It Girl, objectified, swinging London, but it's all gone a little bit sour. So it's kind of funny, but also a little bit, it's a wee bit disturbing, the film, you know, in a sense. It doesn't hold up very well. It's problematic, as we might say now. Mm. And so you've got this, you have this interplay between the kind of the amusement and the sort of the more deeper emotions in the film, which are reflected in the music. And I think Drilling a Home is much more on the kind of funny side. And, you know, George was always into that. You know, I suppose we've got to remember, he sang, you know, I'm Henry VIII, I am, in Hamburg. And he was the one who always kind of had that link and playing the ukulele and those that sort of music hall tradition, which I think you can still hear on elements of this record, you know, that idea of not taking yourself too seriously. And then, of course, taking yourself very seriously indeed. You know, that's always one of the great contradictions of George's. You're never quite sure what ground you're on because, you know, he can pull the rug from under your feet very quickly. So I think you hear that on this record, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, this was on the Mellotron. There's footage, actually, of Eric Robinson and David Nixon from 1965 who were key in sort of promoting it. And obviously it's a tape loop. So basically the lower keys do the basic rhythm, the upper keys you can do the melody, and the middle keys you can do the accompaniment to the tape loops. And they're using this exact setting that George is using.
Well, now I'm going to add the octave in the left hand, and let's try a trombone background.
And so he's literally using a couple of fingers, if indeed it is him playing it. It's kind of like getting one of those old Bontempi organs and pressing number 38, bossa nova. Yeah. But it does the job.
It does the job. No, it's exactly true. And I think he was, I mean, it leads on to, you know, Electronic Sound, you know, the record he made using the Moog, and which got him into a lot of bother in a way, because he's really just using somebody else's demonstration. And sticking out as a record. And George was funny, like, you know, on the one hand, you could say, well, he's very collaborative and he likes to bring in other musicians, but he was also a bit light-fingered. You know, he would just take stuff that was coming out and use it. And, this, I mean, it's kind of like a Benny Hill theme, isn't it? It's got that speeded-up sort of running around madcap thing to it. But I guess, you know, I'd imagine if he was writing this for another project or an album per se that wasn't going to be accompanied by a film, then he might have taken more time over it. I'm guessing that was what written, you know, well, it was obviously written specifically to fit that scene. And it's just got that, it's got that energy, and it communicates a certain kind of amusement and a certain kind of energy and movement that is appropriate. But he was quite impatient in a lot of ways, although he was very methodical a lot of the times. Clearly with new technology, I think he was someone who was just like, right, show me what it does. How do you get that sound? Okay, that's fine. We'll use that. You know, I don't think he was one for sitting down and studying kind of technological stuff. He would do it with instruments, and obviously spent a lot of time on the guitar and the sitar. But when it came to the kind of incipient electronic instruments that were coming around at that time, he got other people really to do the hard work for him.
Yeah, but took all the money. I might cut that out. And the next one you picked is Skiing, in which we hear Mr. Clapton.
We do. Eric Clapton barrels up for a cameo. He's not credited on my version of this record. I think he's credited on the American version under a pseudonym.
Eddie Clayton.
Eddie Clayton, isn't it? Yeah. But you can certainly hear him. You know, it's pretty unmistakable to me. And again, a great big kind of mood swing, a huge great shift in the sound of the record. You know, you have these short, quite gentle instrumentals, and then you get this big barreling blues rock riff. You know, it's really just a riff, isn't it? It's not almost not a song. But you could imagine, you know, funnily, you know, thinking of the White Album that's coming up, you know, 6 months later or whatever, you could imagine that transforming into a song.
Yeah,
on that record, something kind of heavier that's a bit longer. It's really powerful. I think Kula Shaker covered it for Their Sins many years later.
Yeah, go Gokula, the song. So they used that as a riff and then did a... And it's a really good song.
Yeah. Is the Kula Shaker revival, is that on its way, or have I missed it?
I've lost touch after 1997. But it's it's a fantastic song. And what I love about it, it's one of the few songs on here that really does combine East and West, because you've got Santur and Sitar on here as well, providing the bed. And it is a real proper mixture of East. It's a fantastic song.
It really kicks. Yeah, it's got that kind of drone bed, hasn't it, from the Indian instruments, and then this kind of massive big blues rock overlay. And actually, you listen to it and think, God, you could have done a lot with this. You know, George or someone else could have done a lot with that kind of sound. He didn't really explore that. He didn't actually, in many ways, didn't explore the combination or the fusion of Indian and Western music. You know, they tended to be quite distinct. So he would do an Indian song, and it, you know, Within You, Without You, which is, although it's not traditional in terms of its harmonic structure, is very much just using Indian instruments. Mm. Well, you actually think, you know, if you could have blended more of the kind of Western style and instruments, where could you have taken that? And skiing's a little glimpse, a little tiny little kind of portal into where he could have gone with that, maybe. I don't know if he ever felt it was maybe felt it was just a little bit, you know, sacrosanct in a way, that music, but it wasn't something that you stuck a huge, great, filthy guitar riff over the top of. And I don't know. I mean, there's little bits where we hear, you know, him kind of fusing his instruments, but mainly, you know, he sticks to it, either one or the other.
Next, we move to Dream Scene.
Well, see, I think Dream Scene, and maybe slightly fancifully, I've referred to this in the past as a sort of prototype of Revolution Number 9, which it kind of is. It's a very out there. In fact, you could say at this point in the Beatles' career, it's the most experimental piece of music that any Beatle has put out into the public arena, because it's a multi-piece, multi-part, 5.5 minutes. Epic. It's got backwards treated textures on it. It's got, you know, solo trumpet. It's got electronics. It's got dissonant, disjointed mix of instruments. It's genuinely very experimental and quite unsettling, actually. You know, there's the grandfather clocks looming out of the ether orally. Church bells at the end.
Yeah,
it's a really interesting piece. Very, very scene setting. Very, very moody. Very unsettling. And really deeply experimental in a way that I don't think we genuinely think of George Harrison as being, innovative, envelope pushing, all those things. And it's kind of interesting. I often wonder whether it's he kind of needed the safety net or the impetus or the context of the film in order to really pull that out of himself, whether that was the permission he required to be that experimental, you know, because we don't really hear it. We don't really hear that in his, you know, in his day-to-day recordings or in his official records, you know, his own solo albums. And I sometimes wish there was a bit more of that in his music, you know, that he kind of just was a bit less sensible sometimes in his musical choices. Much as I love him, you know, but there can be a sort of staidness or a conventional sense in his music that it's really nicely undermined and dismantled on a lot of this record, but particularly, I think, on Dream Scene, where you really hear him giving himself permission to go out there.
Yeah, it's interesting. We did Living in the Material World recently, and a lot of the songs on there are awesome.
Beautiful, right?
A lot of the songs are low-key, very small George, but similarly, at the time, he was giving things like Sunshine, Life for Me, to Ringo. If he put that on that album, it would have just lifted it even more. But he tended to think jaunty songs weren't important enough, perhaps, at the time. You know, in the 70s, he would have been in that vanguard of serious rock musicians. And thankfully, he didn't go down the sort of cliched path. He went his own direction. But I think the seriousness got perhaps a bit too serious around that time. I think Dark Horse is maybe a bit more playful. But in here, you've got absolutely everything. You've got literally every George there is.
You do. It's so wonderful. Now, it's interesting what you say about Living in the Material World, because I do think it's an album of its times, isn't it? You know, on the back of the concert for Bangladesh in particular, where he's, you know, you forget that he was such a huge solo star as much as anything else. You know, he was obviously a Beatle, but then he became this massive, massive solo star. And you can kind of hear the weight of that on that record. And also he's dealing with God, and he's dealing with trying to be a good spiritual person. And it's a beautiful record, but I do think it's kind of troubled in a way by all those pressures on him. And yes, I'd like to have heard him just kind of allowing himself to have some fun. And then I think on Dark Horse, you hear the opposite. You hear him just kind of dismantling that entire piousness brick by brick. I don't know how conscious it was, but you know, it's kind of patchy and sort of poorly constructed and a bit scrappy. So I think Dream Scene is a really important. I often wonder, I don't think there's much of this on record, what, if any, feedback he got from the Beatles, the other Beatles, about this record and this music, and what, you know, if any of them were just listening out and going. But of course, it didn't come out till a couple of weeks before the White album. So whether they heard stuff in development or heard it before it was actually released, or whether it just came out, they heard it when it came out and they'd already done the White album, I actually don't know. But
I suspect that, bear in mind the trouble Paul had releasing McCartney around the same time as Let It Be. There was a lot of fuss about that. The fact they let George release this a week before the White album, I'm guessing utter indifference, perhaps.
Total. I think so. Certainly they weren't the commercial potential of it, I don't think was troubling anybody. And quite rightly, because I think it pretty much vanished off the face of the earth very, very quickly.
It didn't
really do the kind of evangelical or ambassadorial job that George maybe intended for that music. But I just often wonder if anyone. It's interesting. I've never heard McCartney or anyone say Dream Scene. You know, that was quite interesting. That you know, we listened to that and thought, good old George. You know, he's onto something. But I, like you, I think perhaps they were so wrapped up in their own thing and probably it completely went over or under or around their heads.
Yeah. I just hope if Carnival of Light ever does come out, that it's as good as Dream Scene. I don't think it will be.
I wonder. I don't think it will be. Because it's really quite concise as well. You know, it is only 4, 5.5 minutes. It's not, you know, 16 minutes long. It's actually not indulgent. It's really quite... It really knows what it wants to do and does it, I think, extremely well. And so hats off to George. I think quite often he gets kind of labelled as the sort of Luddite Beatle, and I don't think he was. I just think probably within the structures of the band, he wasn't often allowed to kind of go there. But you hear him going there in this song, and I think it's fascinating. I'd love people to kind of, if they haven't heard it, to lend it their ears.
Next, we have Party Seeker.
Yeah, because Ringo's on this, isn't he? So this, it's kind of trippy, isn't it? Party Seeker almost feels like incipient prog rock or kind of slightly Floyd-y, you know, Pink Floyd-y.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Definitely.
You hear that?
That's on my note. I was just going to say, because Floyd did loads of soundtrack albums in the late 60s. This could be, it's on a par, if not better, than some of the tracks on those, I think.
Yeah. I kind of tie it in, and also tie it in a little bit with things like Flying or It's All Too Much. That those kind of very atmospheric songs that were kind of around at that time that George would have been involved in, Ringo, obviously, as well. So, yeah, it's got a sort of psychedelic rock, a slightly unconventional blues structure in that, you know, it's not sort of 12 beats to the bar or whatever. And you can just hear them having fun. I think you can hear again how much George likes being in a room with a band and just playing. Mm. Around this time, I think you get the sense that he's kind of itching to do a bit more of that. And again, I think you see the White Album coming out of that impulse, you know, a bit more ensemble playing, a bit more of a rock impulse, a bit more of a psychedelic thing going on. So you hear him sort of picking up what's going on around in the music industry at that time, or the music scene at that time, the slightly undergroundy scene. You hear him kind of tapping into that here. I don't know how much of that is him, how much of that is the Remo 4, how much of that is just what came out that day. But it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I think that wah-wah, 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 is, it's got to be George. I mean, he was using wah-wah, or he was using all over the Get Back sessions. Again, you've reminded me, I wonder if, you know, he's leading all these sessions. He's led all the sessions in Bombay. He's led all the sessions in Abbey Road. Then they go to India. He led the way there. And then he comes back and then he's relegated, you know, well, now I ain't going to play on While My Guitar Gently Weeps. That must have all fed into a certain amount of resentment, I guess.
I think so. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, he's not credited as a musician on the record, at least not on my record. But, you know, again, John Barham told me that he definitely did play. He played a lot of piano, actually. You know, again, I think to do with the Indian style of music, which is not something you can really transmit on guitar very well, or translate on guitar very well. I think he played quite a lot of piano. You got the jala, which is the big sort of crescendo at the end of certain tunes, like On the Bed, that I think George did play on. It sounds like him on Party Seekum. It you know, I don't know who else that would be, or if they were just, or a tribute to George, perhaps. You know, they were just kind of, it was a tongue in cheek sort of tribute to him. But I think, I would imagine if he's in a room and they're playing that kind of music, that he would pick up his guitar and play. I can't see how he wouldn't.
Yeah.
And there wouldn't have been anything, you know, there's no contractual thing that says he couldn't do it. So I'd imagine he's on there probably more than a thing.
So the next two tracks, Love Scene and Crying.
I think, you know, these are probably, Love Scene and Crying, two of the most beautiful pieces on the whole record, actually. You know, they're very tender, very emotive. Crying is genuinely quite weird. You know, it's actually quite, again, quite abstract and quite out there. Very mournful. I think it's the Chennai that we hear. And it sounds like weeping. Again, you know, I keep thinking of While My Guitar Gently Weeps, which comes shortly afterwards, and whether, you know, that idea of the kind of instrument weeping, lamenting, was something that George kind of picked up on or was in his mind at that time, because it seems to feed into that idea. And it's really a bit like Microbes. It's a really abstract piece of music.
Mm. I've got nothing else to say. Crying, my notes were, does what it says on the tin.
Yeah.
Replicating the sound of weeping. But it kind of blends into that minor chord at the end. So it starts off with it, and it is, it's oral weeping, literally.
Yeah. Yes. I think so. No, it's genuinely quite kind of avant-garde in its way. And actually, Love Scene, I think we should mention, because it is, again, it's very clever in the sense of it being effectively a kind of duet between two instruments. You've got these sarods sort of playing to each other. Very, you know, really beautiful and clearly quite thoughtful. You know, as much as I think he allowed the musicians to express themselves, you can definitely hear there's a kind of director at work here. You know, there's someone who's really, really thought about how this is going to work, what he wants from the musicians, what he wants the piece to, you know, to portray, the emotion he wants to give the audience. And works really, really well, I think, on both those pieces. And I think they sort of complement each other really well. You have the emotion of the love scene and then the sort of very mournful effect of crying. So I love those two tracks.
We have cowboy music.
Yeah, cowboy music is exactly what it says on. And I wondered if he was listening to the last part of A Quick One while he's away.
Yes.
Have you got that there, bro? See, we're on the
same. Yeah.
You know, he'll soon be home and all that. That seems to me clear. I mean, it's not obviously it's not the most original style of music anyway. It's a kind of pastiche of that clip-clopping. Yeah. Country sound, but it seems a bit of a coincidence that it comes so quickly after the Who.
He would have heard it because they jammed that through the Get Back sessions, singing "Soon Be Home." Yeah, yeah. Like he heard it.
So, light fingered George again, inspired in quote marks by the Who, and it's just great. I mean, again, it's great fun. It's another one of those big kind of handbrake turns from crying to cowboy music. Both tiny little fragments, but emotionally polar opposites.
It's interesting what you said earlier, why he was thinking of this as an album. If you had put all the Indian music on one side, that would have been, well, I guess the term didn't exist, but chill out music, you know, ambient music, would have been beautiful. And then, you know, split the two. I think also the strength is by mixing it, you're going to encourage people at the time to, I like On the Bed or whatever, you know, I like some of the Western stuff. I'll, and you would have physically have to lift the needle off. So it's a way of encouraging people to expand their musical horizons, perhaps.
I imagine that probably was the thought behind it, was that, you're not getting out of this so easily. You can't just play side two of the, you know, this kind of funny cowboy music and nice piano vignettes and stuff. You have to kind of be in there. And I think, it wasn't a criticism. I think it works. I like the kind of the dynamic of the change between, you know, something very, very kind of deeply emotional and quite abstract and then something quite silly and throwaway.
Next, On the Bed, which is one of the highlights for me, and it's hinting at some of the descending chords George later used on it, isn't it? A pity.
I agree. I think On the Bed's kind of archetypal. Well, it would become archetypal in terms of George's style. We might see the beginning of it here very briefly. Now, actually, I was told Big Jim Sullivan, the great session player, is on this record, is on this track. I don't think he's ever been credited anywhere for it, but... John Barham, who did play on it, told me that he was playing, Jim Sullivan was playing a Tom Jones session, and he dropped in and played bass on the Bed. So I think there's another person who...
Why would you lie about, why would you make that up?
Well, I suppose you could misremember that, but no, he's very clear, I think, about how things went down. So And and he also told me that it was inspired by Ravi Shankar's sessions for Alice in Wonderland, which he did with Jonathan Miller.
Yeah.
And George went along to kind of see that and was watching Ravi playing, and this combination of sitar and piano, which I think is kind of quite unusual. And another one, this jala texture, which is this kind of this climactic piano sequence. So I think it's a very beautiful track. It's very kind of pertinent to where George would end up going musically. I think it also shows how deeply he was kind of immersed in that music and understood how it could work. I remember John Barham said he was astonished actually how competent he was at kind of translating those musical ideas, which were quite complex. Given it'd only been two years since he'd seriously been studying. Yeah, and in that time he's still nominally a Beatle. He's still making records with the Beatles and playing a lot of other kinds of music. But you know, I think a lot of the time away from that he was absolutely immersed in this stuff.
Yeah.
And you can really hear it.
We think December 67, it's just over a couple of years since he did Norwegian Woods. And throughout 67, you know, I printed out a list of the times he went to India. He was just in and out all the time. And it was his raison d'etre, you know, it was everything to him. And again, this is another one that really combines beautifully, I think, Western and Eastern. Without, you couldn't call it either, really, but it works.
I think, yeah, and I think you kind of have to think to conclude that he's probably one of the few people at that point who could have done that, who had the wherewithal and the understanding and the commitment and the love of both kind of sides of the tradition to be able to do that and do it authentically and beautifully. And it's so, it's so short. And I want, you know, it's another thing I wonder is, where are the full versions of some of these tracks? You know, are there 5 or 6 minute versions of some of these, what are essentially fragments, you know, 1 minute long pieces? Or did he just, you know, stop the stopwatch and go, right, that's it, down to, yeah. Or did they get into that groove where, you know, they were playing for much longer and then he just chopped it? But it seems to be that, no, they kind of recorded to the slot available and they were very...
Which he would have got from George Martin. There's a lot of osmosis going on. He's surrounded by the Beatles. He's surrounded by Ravi Shankar, George Martin. And this is the kind of thing that's coming out of him.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
There is always that, I think, that discipline, isn't there? There's always that sense of, no matter how kind of experimental they got, there was always that discipline of, we have to get this done and we have to kind of, it has to work for what we're doing. It's not just about playing forever and ever and ever and ever. So I'm guessing he brought a lot of that early discipline that the Beatles had to this project, because it is very, very on the nose. It's not kind of rambling all over the place.
It's exactly what you're saying. I totally agree, because 2 days after Wonderful Music was released, he recorded Electronic Sound, or at least half of it. So he basically...
Well, he was in the room.
Right, that's the second album done.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, that's a whole other story, Electronic Sound, but... Yeah, I mean, you think this guy at this point is kind of very much, you know, he's seceding from the band, really. Slowly but surely, you sense this guy's got his own agenda musically that it's so far kind of from what the Beatles are doing at that point. It's quite interesting. Yeah.
And also, I think you mentioned Jonathan Miller's Alice in Wonderland, which at the time was hugely inspirational for a lot of UK bands. And again, in bringing Eastern music over to the West. In a similar way to this, in a sort of Western format, you couldn't get any more Western than Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
But with this beautiful instruments, like you say, people wouldn't have heard in that context before.
I think that's so true. I mean, I guess it was, I suppose we always have to remember that this stuff was kind of in the air, wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't just happening in a vacuum. There was a sort of cultural, societal interest in Eastern philosophy and Eastern music. The Beatles were kind of either at the forefront of or became involved in after the fact. But, you know, it was a very, I think, exciting time and a very liberating time from, and yes, as you say, you go back 2 years and you have, I think Ravi Shankar called the sitar on Norwegian Wood that it sounded like it was a soap commercial. You know, it is awful, twanging, cheap sort of Woolworths sound of kind of gratuitous exoticism, really. Influential and significant in its own way. But, you know, things moved so quickly. And as you say, 2 years later, you have a very, very deep immersion that is speaking to what's happening in a wider cultural context as well. I think the Beatles were always good at that. When they always had their antennae up and their eyes open to what was happening in the culture. And this record, more so than the film, I mean, the film is probably a kind of very dated example of what was going on at that time cinematically. I think the record speaks quite clearly about what was happening in the culture at that time, and that blending of desire to blend different traditions and find out more about different things.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, the album's definitely dated better than the film. Next, we have the penultimate track, Wonderwall to Be Here. High drama and lots of mellotron.
It's beautiful, isn't it, Wonderwall to Be Here? I think it's very dramatic, very lush, very filmic, actually, in a way that quite a lot of the other music on the album isn't. It's got a kind of Bollywood sense of drama to it that is really beautiful, yeah. And again, the mellotron. Yeah, no, I think it's one of the most beautiful pieces on the record, but very different. Again, very different, even in an Indian music context. You know, it's still sort of pushing the boundaries. And of course, the place where the sort of title, you know, the title pun, the Liverpudlian humour kind of coming out in the clunking pun of Wonderwall and Wonderful, yeah. And I think, you know, I hear bits of, I mean, do we hear bits of While My Guitar Gently Weeps in there slightly in the kind of...
The chord structure, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. The chord structure and that sort of descending.
Yeah, minor chords.
Yeah.
It could actually, yeah. Oh, I might have to do a mashup. Again, John Barham, he was key on the mellotron arrangement on this as well. But I think his involvement overall, you know, he did have a lot of input. What other things was he telling you about the album?
Well, he was hugely impressed, you know, because I think he, you know, as you'll know, he was a very serious scholar of Indian music, and also someone who was quite sceptical, healthily sceptical, I would say, about the sort of... the way a lot of Western musicians and rock musicians were kind of tapping into that at that time. You know, I think he felt it was a sort of easy access to a spiritual awakening that perhaps wasn't as sincere or in-depth as it was. And I think perhaps he felt that with George initially, that this is just another rock star dipping his toes in the water. And he was very impressed by how sincere he was. You know, they met, he went around to his house and they played together. And, he felt that George really understood what he wanted from this music, why he loved it, and he understood how it worked kind of from the inside out. And so John Barham, you know, when we were talking about living in the material world, you know, it's an immense contribution he makes to that record. Those are string arrangements on that, much more, I think, beautiful, than Things Must Pass, you know, because it's such, as you said, such a small record, and the arrangements are so detailed and kind of fragile in a way. You could really ruin that record if you didn't have a kind of a very nice sense of what was required. So he became a very important collaborator. I mean, it starts here and it continues. And I think everyone I spoke to, certainly about George's influence and George's interest in India, Indian music, Indian spirituality, always emphasized that it was not, you know, he was no dilettante, you know, he was very, very sincere about it, and he worked really, really hard, you know, because I think Ravi told him, well, you know, it'll take you 50 years to get good. Yeah. And George's like, well, okay, you know, I've got 50 years, I'll really work at it. And he did, you know, and as you said, he was going over to India a lot during this period, and he was, you know, practicing the sitar and studying it really properly, and how to sit with it and how to cradle it and how to, you know, how to make a bowl out of your feet and all these things that are really integral to how you play that instrument. And, yeah. But coming back to Wonderwall to Be Here, you know, it's another one of those integrated performances, I think, on this record, where you can hear, you know, because the band Remo 4 are on it and they're playing, but you also hear the other influences as well. And I think it's a really nice blend.
Tony Ashton's piano is beautiful as well.
Just, I mean, and a kind of extemporized, just a cascade of beauty. Yeah, it's absolutely stunning. And again, you kind of do think, oh, I wish there was a little bit more of this. It's very short.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a song there, I think. I wonder whether there was melodies or whether there was ideas or lyrical things that George felt fitted to some of this music, because you can definitely hear, you know, half a dozen of those tunes, they are potential songs.
Oh, definitely.
But then again, maybe they did lead to, you know, there's a great outpouring in Rishikesh and all these songs that come out for the White Album, and maybe that's just a kind of, maybe that's him chipping at the door of that particular project and that process, and it's a way of allowing these other songs to come out, having done that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but you can definitely hear that. I do hear and do see sort of footprint very much leading towards other things from this record that George and the Beatles did.
So we end the album with Singing Om.
We have vocals. We don't know who they are. I don't think they've ever been credited who's singing on that. And again, you know, back to God, I think, back to that connection, back to that kind of Vedic. Well, not back to it. This was the first time we hear that sort of chant, that connection that we will later hear on My Sweet Lord and things like that. You know, that sense of singing to your God, blending it with a kind of more Western style of music. It's a very peaceful and quite kind of quietly profound end to the record. And I think interesting that he does end it with an Indian piece, a spiritual piece. It doesn't end with cowboy music. He's not clip-clopping off into the sunset with a cowboy hat on. You know, it ends kind of becalmed and very peacefully. And it's a very apt ending to the record, I think.
Absolutely. And then obviously during this, The Inner Light was recorded, which would end up on the B-side of Lady Madonna. And also during the 98, when Massett decided to restore the film, George dug around and found In the First Place, another Remo 4 song, but this time with actual vocals. The Inner Light we know about, but it's, you know, he's come back from Bombay. Right, lads, I've got this. And Paul and John are actually doing backing vocals on this, so they're fully supportive of that. I guess less so with the whole album.
I mean, The Inner Light, I think, is really interesting because, as you say, you know, it was recorded during those, the instrumental track was recorded during those Bombay sessions, and then the Beatles add to it, you know, and it is, a rare and genuine kind of fusion of those styles, and I suppose a rare fusion of George's interests and the Beatles' interests, you know, because in the previous records, when he'd made Indian music, you know, they hadn't really appeared. You know, they're not on Within You Without You, I don't think. So it's very much this kind of solo track on the record, whereas here, they're adding something to it, and it would have been interesting to have heard a bit more of
that. Well, I suppose it wasn't long before they were headed off to India anyway. It's only like days or weeks. So their enthusiasm, oh, right, let's get a bit of taste of this. So there was genuine enthusiasm for it. But yeah, interestingly, none for the previous songs.
It's really interesting. And I just do wonder about those conversations that they may have had. You know, your mate's just come back from Bombay and spent, as you say, an inordinate amount of time in India in the past 18 months, and they're going off to Rishikesh. And surely there would have been a conversation about, well, what's it like? You know, and obviously it's a huge country, and it's a different, very different geographical part of the country they were going to. But you'd have thought there would be, George would be kind of telling them about what to expect or how amazing it was, or... Mm. Because we hear a lot about the Maharishi, which of course is, you know, was obviously the kind of trigger for them going. But yeah, I just wonder what conversations they would have had in the studio. George is just back from this incredible trip, and he's got this beautiful music that he's obviously played them some of it. He played them The Inner Light, so that I don't know how much else he may have played them, but he obviously played them some of it. And you just wonder how much that did fire them up to kind of take the plunge to go and work with them. And I often think he doesn't really get the credit for that, for kind of really being at that point the instigator of this particular part of the Beatles story.
And Patty as well.
And Patty as well, yeah.
So, I think there's an interview with John with Brian Matthew, of all people, on the quaint old British radio station, and they're talking about John saying, yeah, we came back one day and there was, I think his quote was, thousands of Indian musicians, and he has got a bit of a sarcastic, and a swinging time was had by all. I don't think he was particularly into it at that point.
No, but it's funny because, you quite often hear George, you know, being slightly disparaging about Sergeant Pepper and that kind of municipal Englishness that album picks up on. But then you hear some of that on this record. You know, you definitely hear Drilling a Home has that sense of kind of old English municipal comedy. Yeah. So it's not quite as simple as just saying, well, one of them was in one place and the rest of them were somewhere else. There was constantly, obviously, a dialogue, even if it wasn't overt, you know, there was an exchange of influences and interests that was always happening within that band. And this is a particularly kind of febrile time, I think, because obviously they'd stopped playing live. And so they're really exploring their own interests and then bringing bits of those interests back, and you kind of hear bits of them getting integrated into the band.
Yeah.
So I think it's a quietly influential record in a lot of ways.
I think also the artwork is beautiful. You know, Bob Gill, yes, the famous story about George saying, yeah, I want you to remove one of the bricks, and the artist got really pissed off about it. But it's a good idea, and secondly, it's what happens in the film.
Exactly.
So, come on, Bob.
Yeah.
And also, there's that beautiful photo of George taken by Astrid in the gatefold sleeve, and Astrid's still there.
I was going to say, if for nothing else, buy this record for the best picture of George Harrison that exists anywhere in the world. I really do think it's the most beautiful picture of George. It just captures him. Oh, it's beautiful. And it's Astrid. You know, it's Astrid again who just knows how to photograph these boys. And I think him in particular. It's the most beautiful photograph. And I wish I put it on the cover of my book, actually, now, because I think it's so soulful. And it speaks somehow of him kind of taking control of his own destiny in a way. I think that photograph, you kind of see him going, I know who I am now, and I'm moving forward. And it's a sort of farewell to the Beatles, which in a way the record kind of is. It's the first step away from the band and away from his boyhood, I guess, in a way, his adolescence, these connections with these people who have been so important to him. But you can kind of hear and see him starting to sever those connections, and it's quite moving in that way, in a funny sort of way.
So Graham Thompson, thank you so much. Overall, what does this album mean to you, and what would you say to people who maybe haven't heard it, and to encourage them to dip their toe in?
It means a lot to me. I mean, I come back to it actually quite often now. I like writing to it. I think it's increasingly, I like writing to instrumental music, and I like writing to interesting music that doesn't sort of actually doesn't bleed into the background, but it has a kind of constant trickle of interest in my head. And I just think the dynamics of it are really interesting. So I think the first thing to say is it's a good record, and it's a nice record to listen to. As much as we might want to talk about its influence or its significance or what it means in terms of the Beatles, or it was the first this or the first that. It's got some really great music on it, I think. Really, really beautiful music on it. And I would encourage anyone to kind of immerse themselves in it and listen to it. And I think if you have George pegged as a certain kind of person or musician, or you kind of think you know his place in the narrative of this incredible story of the Beatles that, you know, we're all so fascinated by, I think this shifts the kind of perception a little bit. I think it might give you a greater insight, or it might just challenge a few of your preconceptions about who he was, what he was capable of, how he in his own way kind of dictated some of the moves that the Beatles made in their latter years. So I think it's a really rich record, and it's and the stuff on there you won't hear anywhere else.
Graham Thompson, thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure, Chris. Thank you very much. Hey!